Hello and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU provides each of our listeners with current information on a wide variety of topics related to health, athletic performance, fitness, and nutrition. On track one, Corey will provide his commentary adapted from the Certified Sports Nutrition Advisor Education Program, current research data, and his clinical experience. On track two, he will be joined by Tracy Hawley on He Said, She Said, for her female focus on topics related to whole food, health, relationships, and raising healthy children. Track 3 features an interview with our special guest, who will share their expertise and experience in the healthcare, fitness, and sports nutrition field. Here is Corey Hawley and this month's presentation of Sports Nutrition Update.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sports Nutrition Update, Volume 12, Number 1. This episode launches once again another great year of SNU tutorials and guest interviews. Volume 12 means we are commencing our 12th straight consecutive year. And of course, I always look forward to some great discussions and discoveries with our special expert guests. In the last edition of Clinical Review, I discussed principles of sports nutrition number 15, endocrine glands. The endocrine glands are ductless glands that manufacture and release hormones, tiny substances with powerful effects, proving the adage, big things come in small packages. The endocrine glands are part of a very specialized and delicate network called the endocrine system. The endocrine, or endocrine, you can say it both ways, the endocrine system is one of 11 unique but highly interdependent biological systems, all of which collaborate together to keep us functional and well. In addition to the endocrine system, the other 10 biological systems include the integumentary system, which is the system of the skin, the muscular system, the skeletal system, the respiratory system, the digestive system, cardiovascular system, lymphatic system, urinary system, reproductive system, and the nervous system. On this edition of Clinical Review, my mind is on the topic of sustainability. It's come up in a lot of conversations recently, and I've just also put an article together on that topic. So my title for this episode is Sustainability, What It Really Means. We've all heard about sustainability in relation to economics, the environment, social welfare, and the planet as a whole. But what about individual sustainability, as opposed to the collective or the earth or the environment? Just for a moment, let's focus on how we live and what we ourselves are doing to ourselves, as in to our own mind and body. Never mind the environment. What's going on at home? The question here is my life sustainable? Can I keep living the way I'm living right now and not suffer any illness, infection, breakdown, injury, or degeneration of the mind and body? And in actuality, if you analyze someone and you look for illness, infection, breakdown, injury, or degeneration of the mind or body, you'll find it's because they're living unsustainably. You see, if what we are doing or not doing right now in real time is contributing to our own personal demise in any manner, it's time to stop the insanity. It's time to change, and of course the time is now. There is only now. The root word of sustainability is sustain, which is derived from the Latin word sustenere. Sustenere means to uphold, support, or bear the weight of. Think of Atlas the Titan in Greek mythology, who held up the celestial sphere. In this example, Atlas was able to bear the weight of the world because of who and what he was, a powerful and huge immortal being of incredible strength and stamina. And with our brain potential in mind, aren't we a bit like Atlas? As a side note here, I'm reminded of the great novel Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. In this example, Atlas shrugs the weight of the world off his shoulders in order to survive. It was an intellectual and moral decision. He had decided in this depiction that he was not going to bear the weight of everyone else and try and meet their expectations and live for their approval. And the same is also true for many of us. Sometimes we have to shrug off whatever obligation we have in order to survive, in order to stay well and to stay alive. As a health professional dedicated to evidence-based, holistic sports nutrition, my first and foremost objective when examining the state and welfare of any athlete is to determine the sustainability of their training, diet, and lifestyle. It either is or it isn't sustainable, and I make this judgment call based on evidence obtained from a detailed analysis of diet, a fitness assessment, and a variety of biomarkers identified in blood, urine, and saliva. It's called a reality check. Now, by coming to terms with what is, as in the here and now, it's possible to determine whether or not the person in question can continue living, training, and eating the way they do without suffering from chronic disease, injury, depression, or premature death. You see, most cannot, and often they are blind to the facts or live in denial. We frequently allow some superimposed, outdated tradition or social obligation to control our actions, and for whatever reason or reasons, we remain loyal to a fault. How do we know it's a fault? The fault is validated as a fault or error in judgment by the evidence of the individual's poor mental, emotional, or physical health. Good causes have good effects. Bad causes have bad effects. This is basic science. Now, life is a gift, and science is a wonderful guide, a wonderful teacher, a wonderful method. The purpose of life is to live, not die. Our purpose is to survive and stay alive, not give up the ghost prematurely. Now, these statements may seem obvious, but why then are so many people in today's modern world suffering from autoimmune conditions, obesity, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and mental illness? Why are so many people actually stabbing themselves in their own eye with the fork in their hand that they're holding? Why do they do this? What do you think? What is the answer? I think part of the solution, as opposed to simply recognizing the problem and doing nothing about it, including even thinking about it, is revealed in how people live in relation to the principle of cause and effect. You see, in my rational world of functional health and wellness, fitness and optimum nutrition are absolutely essential to sustain a healthy, functional human long-term. This is a scientific fact. Without consistent workouts, progressive athletic training, and a clean whole food diet reinforced with dietary supplements, it's simply not possible to outsmart the forces of nature during your lifespan. Thinking as a scientist, how can we possibly take on the forces of nature? Easy. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. Entropy, oxidation, cosmic radiation, and gravity all directly affect me, and me is what it's all about, at least from my point of view. So the first step is to observe and analyze. You see, without the me in this equation, there is nothing to perceive, consider, or debate. If I don't exist, the entire matter is moot or closed, meaning it has no practical value. In the context of my existence, if I'm dead, there's no point to a discussion about anything because, in essence, I simply can't. A person who doesn't exist can't have a discussion about their own existence. So everything is about being alive. So do you see what I mean by sustainability and its importance? You have to stay alive and keep your brain intact in order to think about what you're doing. Dead men tell no tales. Everything that is, in terms of matter and energy, no longer applies to someone who is dead. Yes, we understand the first law of thermodynamics and that energy can't be destroyed and we all return to dust and particles and elements. I get that. But at this stage of my own game, as in the game of my personal life and existence, I don't have any need or motive to believe in any afterlife of any kind. First and foremost, there's absolutely no physical evidence I can examine to validate the concept. And let me make this clear. Belief or faith is not evidence. And this 55-year-old dude needs evidence to objectively determine and rationalize what's going on. I mean, in the big picture, I've met with Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, Muslims, Christians, Taoists, Baha'is, and even Rastafarians, just to name a few. And I have met with them on their own turf, in their own temples, churches, and synagogues, and I've even gone to the countries where the great religions began. I've read all of their texts, holy scriptures, and sacred books with great interest and an open mind. And without exception, the hardcore fundamentalists that subscribe to these belief systems all believe that what they believe in is absolute. But to remain as objective as possible, keeping in mind that the biggest obstacle to gaining knowledge is the illusion of knowledge itself, they can't all be true at the same time. That doesn't compute. It's all secondhand religion, meaning everything they believe in was handed down to them as gospel. The stuff they think is true, they didn't invent. They were told the idea that they cling on to by someone else. That's what we mean by secondhand. They themselves didn't meet God. Someone else supposedly did, and the story about that is what they believe in. Now, no one alive has ever seen God or touched the hand of God, and when you bow your head and pray, which is your private privilege, and in no mean do I mean any disrespect to anyone that does that, that doesn't mean that you're connecting with anything or anybody other than your own mind. It seems that most religious people, convinced by their own mind that what they believe is true, all believe that competing systems of belief are wrong or off the beaten path of what they perceive as truth. For example, Muslims don't believe they have to accept Jesus into their heart to be saved. Jews don't accept Jesus as the Messiah. Baptist Christians don't agree with the doctrine of Catholicism, and Jehovah's Witnesses don't accept Babe or Bab as a messenger of truth in the Baha'i faith. Mormons certainly don't believe that Lord Brahma is the god of creation, but the Hindus sure do. And I could go on and on and on. It's an infinite regress. I mean, the number of doctrines out there is mind-boggling. So like Bertrand Russell, I take a step back. I analyze it all. I live on reason. Reason is my guiding tool. I go for things I can measure and validate using physics, math, and biology. I use these tools of science to help me interpret reality. Now, Russell said, believe what is, don't believe in what isn't, and for everything else, suspend judgment. So when it comes to the interpretation of so-called absolute truth, don't be too hasty. Science itself teaches that certainty doesn't exist. And Einstein said, if you want to learn about yourself and relative truth, study nature. Richard Dawkins also directs us to this cause. Get involved with the study of nature, the microscopic and telescopic view of everything that exists, and it'll blow your mind, it'll help resolve a lot of issues that you have within yourself, and it will help straighten out a lot of things that don't make sense to you. You see, I recognize myself as a sovereign creature of nature, a biological entity with both the right to its own life and the right to interpret my existence. I accept that I'm a unique byproduct of evolution. I'm not a slave to men, nor do I worship any self-imagined or invisible entity I can't see or touch. And I definitely don't rely on my emotions as a guide for truth. Of course, I recognize and respect everyone's right to believe in whatever they want to believe in, however bizarre it might seem, whatever floats your boat, turns your crank, or cooks your cupcake, I guess. Just don't impose your supposed truth on me, which is much different from having a friendly conversation or exchange of ideas on common ground about what you think is going on. I think this is how we learn. We can sit down in a benevolent manner and exchange ideas and learn from each other and then move forward from there. Did aliens alter our DNA 25,000 years ago? Are we clones from another star system? Not likely, but of course no one can prove that Santa Claus doesn't exist. So to explore the infinite number of possibilities possible to imagine can be fun, but unless I can validate the belief or notion somehow or some way, like I can with nutrition or training, it's not something I'm personally going to sink my teeth into. I like to be aware of it, and I'm certainly interested in people and history and what makes them tick, but that's much different from putting all of my eggs in a make-believe basket that was formed and formulated by another man in the past. When I die, and I use this term very lightly because I perceive death as something that is uncommon, it's not something that I buy into from a conventional point of view. The principal I, as in me, that dies, as in my consciousness, my identity, my self-awareness, or the thing that I am that gives me a sense of my individual identity, perhaps a being of light, that I will cease to exist. It turns off when I expire, just like how a light bulb turns off when you hit the switch. Go ahead, walk into a room and look at the light when it's on. Now, turn it off. Could it be that it's all really that simple? Who or what were we prior to conception? Did we exist? If you believe you existed prior to the moment of your own conception, then whatever you believe in is a matter of faith. I personally don't think I existed prior to my physical cellular existence, meaning prior to being a cluster of human cells, an embryo, and a baby that grew from the union of my father's sperm and my mother's egg. And if I did, I'm certainly not aware or conscious of it. Of course, I know nothing compared to what is actually known in totality. Socrates said he was the wisest of all because he knew the least of everyone, and he admitted it. When my lights go out, meaning when my DNA ceases to project my consciousness in the form of bioelectrical energy, a type of living energy animated that flashes like lightning across and through the 100 billion neurons in my brain, I will become and go back to the same place I was before I started. Nowhere and nothing. And I, for one, find great comfort in accepting that as a logical possibility. Now, what has any of this got to do with sustainability? Well, the short answer is everything. Your philosophy of life determines your pattern of life. What you believe in is what you achieve. In the most general sense, we are limited or not primarily by ourselves and what we believe or deny. Do you want to suffer with the same pain, disability, or disease patterns as your parents or grandparents? Or would you rather live free so you can train, study, grow, and travel worldwide for the rest of your life? Do you believe it's possible to live without disease and infection? To live without being a slave to negative emotions and fear? I do. Absolutely. If we took a telescopic, objective view of your lifestyle right now and analyzed it, what would we find? Is your current life strategy and pattern of living day-to-day sustainable? In practical terms, I'm talking about your diet, your exercise pattern, your sleep routine, and the work you do. Is your entire life viewed as a whole system sustainable long-term? If so, I commend you for taking this approach and for being truly wise. But if not, why not? Only we ourselves are capable of making whatever changes are necessary. Primum non nocere. Edge that into your brain. First, do no harm. Sustaining yourself in a state of optimum health and wellness on every possible level is your first and only obligation. Well, that's it for this segment of SNU. Thanks for listening. And here's a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, essayist, lecturer, and poet. What lies behind us and what lies before us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us.